Welcome to another edition of Stormy Weather News from the Frontline in the End Times. This is the Ale Escapers, and I'm coming to you not at all live from somewhere in the universe. I have a few topics that I want to discuss today. I'm not sure any particular order, but they're topics that haven't been fully expressed in previous podcasts or that have come up at the blog. That is www.alescafus.blogspot.com, stormy weather. I'm going to begin this week right off with a continuation of the theme that I touched upon two podcasts ago, the Illuminati R Us podcast, about the idea that the Masonic sorcerers of the global elite et al. Are feeding us clues in order to encourage us, subtly manipulate us, to create or build upon the narrative that they wish us to create, and therefore empower them in our consciousness and through our consciousness. And I thought that I would give an example of this, which has occurred to me recently. It's quite a mundane or trivial example, but I think it pretty much shows what I'm talking about, what I was trying to get at. It's the example of the Kubrick film Eyes Wide Shut. First of all, I'll describe, if I can, a little better what I mean by this process by which the elite use ourselves, and particularly researchers among us, to weave their own narrative, or weave a narrative that is serving their ends. It relates to the idea of join the dots. It's no doubt relevant that David Icke's, I think, most recent book, although who knows with Icke, because he just turns these books out at such a rapid pace, they just seem to keep on coming. I haven't actually read any of Icke's books except for the one, the Everything is Infinite Love, yada 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 book, which I did enjoy, and I do respect Icke and his work. And he does have a very appealing manner, but there's something about his method of delivery, both in the books and in his stage performances, which I find very suspect. And it relates to, on the one hand, he's kind of dumbing down, on the other hand, he's pumping up his stuff. I think it's a bad combination. He's going for the lowest common denominator, which is, of course, why he's a bestseller. And anyway, it's a total digression. But so we've got the idea of joining the dots, as Icke recommends, to figure out what's going on in the world. And Icke says if you look at these various different elements in our society, and rather than allow them to exist in isolation, if we actually try and connect them together, then we will see the greater pattern that's behind them. And this is, of course, what any conspiracy researcher does. He sees recurring themes, he sees connections between different political agendas, social, cultural memes or themes, and he traces a pattern, uncovers this hidden design. But what I'm wanting to suggest here is that this is actually the method by which the Masonic sorcerers trick us into perceiving and then even drawing a pattern that doesn't exist, or that wouldn't exist without our collaboration. And it's a little like the Rorschach thing. It's like a Rorschach blot that is cleverly designed so that although we think we're discovering something in there, it's actually the colors and the shapes have actually been subtly placed there so that we will see what we're supposed to see. But it's still, there's still an element of the Rorschach thing in there, that we are actually projecting our own stuff onto that image. And so this is a creative process. Whenever I describe these things, I never intend to describe them as wholly negative. There is definitely a positive aspect to what the Masonic sorcerers are doing and what I'm describing here, but it only really becomes so if we become aware of it, aware of our collaborative, of how we are actually creating the narrative ourselves. And if we do so unconsciously, there's two results. One is we think that we're actually discovering an empirical nuts and bolt reality when it's not, it's subtler than that. And the other is that, as I've said, we are actually playing into the hands of the secret architects of this agenda and drawing the picture that they want to draw. So to continue the simile anyway, there's a pattern there that's hidden. And the Masonic sorcerers are emphasizing certain dots, let's say, certain aspects of that pattern, which they use as clues. They allow these elements through the revelation of the method to come to the consciousness of the conspiracy researcher and to attract his or her attention. And these are apparently random elements that have just been revealed, have been exposed, or somehow slipped through the cloak of concealment. But in actual fact, they are specifically chosen, according to the rules of the revelation of the method, to be revealed to us. And the intent is that because we will only have these select clues, these select dots, that do pertain to the hidden pattern, but have been specifically selected so that we will perceive an image which is actually very different from the pattern that is concealed. And I feel like I need to think of to give an example here, a very simple example. For example, if you had an image of an elephant and a concealed image, and if you isolated certain portions of the elephant as dots and left the rest of the elephant, all the remaining portions, concealed, then the perceiver would join those dots and assume that he was creating a picture that was true, but it would depend upon which dots were being emphasized or being revealed. And so, for example, if the Masonic sorcerer simply revealed aspects of the elephant's trunk, then we might join those dots and think we had a complete picture, and we would think that it was a snake that was being hidden, when in fact we had missed the larger part of this image of this creature. And this is what I'm trying to get at, is that they allow the truth to come out, but very carefully selected, so that we will put together these various facts, discoveries, and we will draw a picture of it prematurely of what they pertain to, and then we will jump to conclusions and say, okay, this is the agenda that is being concealed, when in actual fact we have created a picture by using the dots that we've been given, rather than simply refraining from joining them, from just looking for more dots, is what I'm getting at. It's too soon to start joining the dots. Way too soon. We don't even know how big the image is, how big the backdrop is. So we might think, oh, we've got plenty of dots now, so we can start joining them, because my God, this is a whole global network, and it entails this and that, and all these different agendas. That's certainly big enough an image. Yeah, that must be more or less complete, so let's just start joining them. But no, it doesn't just pertain to the Earth, it pertains to the solar system and the galaxy and the universe. So we haven't even begun to trace the hidden aspects of this agenda that pertain to the universe. We're, as conspiracy researchers anyway, we're focusing on the Earth and on society, and so things that appear satanic do so because they're in a particular context. And this is really, I think, the bottom line about the Masonic sorcerers, is that they're serving an agenda that is satanic from one perspective, but from another point perspective is simply galactic. And if we get locked into their perspective, then that is exactly what they want. We have to allow them to be what they are. We don't want to kid ourselves, but to then put them in the perspective of a truer mythic narrative, rather than the one that they would have us create, that they are attempting to create through our consciousness. Otherwise they will simply remain satanic overlords, and we will remain victims to them, or subjects of them. So anyway, so that's more or less a summary of what I'm attempting to posit here. And this is what I'm aiming for, what I'm moving towards, is a new paradigm for parapolitical researchers, for occult researchers for sorcerers in the social domain, for paranoid awareness to go to the next level and become one step closer to lucidity. Okay, to get to the example that I had in mind, Eyes Wide Shut. Eyes Wide Shut, of course, was Stanley Kubrick's last movie, came out in 1999, and it was a movie that has attracted a lot of attention from conspiracy research because it revolved around secret societies, rituals, possibly mind control, the occult, and of course because of the fact that Stanley Kubrick died before the film was released in the last stages of post-production. Now, there's various elements I want to bring up about the film. The reason I brought this up as an example is that there are theories have come up since then that Kubrick was actually revealing hidden truths about the Masonic sorceress through his film because of the subject matter, the fact that it shows supposedly the inner workings of these occult rituals. We have the cloaked figures in the country mansion, the incense, the candles, the sacrificial daggers, the naked females, etc. It's all very similar to the satanic ritual abuse and or secret society occult rituals that every occult conspiracy researcher is familiar with. So the theory goes is that Kubrick was revealing secrets that he had was privy to as an inner as a member of the inner circle of the Masonic elite, and that he was taken out for this. And this really is, it doesn't hold up. I'm going to be generous now because there's researchers whom I respect who have put forward this idea, at least in a tentative way. For anyone who's seen the film, it's really a laughable film, utterly unconvincing at every level, I think it's safe to say, as a film. And the thing is that the film was absolutely panned when it was first released, which anyone who's seen the film would understand why. But because Kubrick died right before the film was released, there was definitely less vitriol than I think there would have been. And what happened was curious. Within a few months of the film's release, there had been a sort of new meme was being created that was suggesting that the film was misunderstood and that actually it was Kubrick's last masterpiece and etc., etc. And I don't think this would have happened so easily or so quickly if Kubrick hadn't died. I don't want to spend too much time on this subject, but what I wanted to get at was that the film I saw was just a ridiculous, totally harmless and kooky depiction of Masonic sorcerers at play. The occult ritual that Tom Cruise's character stumbles into, it is basically no more sinister than a bunch of naked women who are being used as apparently as sort of ritualistic sex slaves. The film depicts a very mild view of what goes on behind closed doors at satanic rituals. And so the idea that somehow the Masonic sorcerers wish to suppress this information is patently ridiculous. In a sense, it creates the very picture of them and their activities that they would wish to, rather like Bohemian Grove, I think, is another example. The Bohemian Grove, the mere fact that Alex Jones managed to infiltrate the Bohemian Grove and actually get photographs and even footage, makes it pretty obvious, to me at least, that it was all set up through revelation of the method, and that Bohemian Grove, simply like Eyes Wide Shut, is a way to relieve the sense of suspicion and dread about what is going on in secret and what these secret Masonic elite are up to by giving them a simulated surrogate version of the mysteries. This rather quaint, rather ridiculous image of important political, social figures wearing robes, worshipping an owl, urinating in the forest, no small children being abused, no bloodletting, no ritual sacrifices, none of that. Although, of course, the more informed percipient is going to assume these elements might be entailed, but overall, the very fact that somehow we're able to see what's going on in these hidden rituals makes them seem less threatening, makes them seem like what they really are, just kooky, harmless, rather pitiful, somewhat sinister, but basically harmless. rituals with very eccentric public figures. And I think we know that this isn't the case. Whatever is really going on in these rituals is not going to get captured on camera by parapolitical researchers who've managed to infiltrate inner workings of the Masonic elite. This is simply not going to happen. So if Jones or whoever was able to get into Bohemian Grove and get footage, it was only precisely because he was allowed to do. But if this is the case, then this is an example of us being given certain dots with the knowledge and the certainty that we will join them in precisely the way that we're supposed to be joining them, and so we'll come up with an erroneous view. My view of Eyes Wide Shut is that Kubrick did have some connections with the Masonic elite, and that he made a movie that he wished to delve into these matters to some extent, but that of course he was very tightly controlled and directed into how much he could reveal, and that essentially what he did reveal, not only was it non-threatening to that elite, but it was actually useful to them, because as I say, it made those ritual workings seem ridiculous. And then that Kubrick perhaps did fake his own death after the movie. This seems a possible alternative narrative that we don't hear about, in order to retire in the fullest way possible, and also to salvage his film from disappearing utterly from the realms of film history by dying at that time and being canonized as this great filmmaker, as he would have to be in his death. His last film gained a sort of respectability and credibility that otherwise it wouldn't have done. I think this seems like a more likely explanation for the supposed coincidence of Kubrick dying immediately after the film was finished. So the idea that Kubrick was assassinated is very useful to the Masonic elite, because then it gives credibility to the film and it makes us think this is actually revealing something that they don't want us to know. And it also, of course, strengthens the idea of their power, that they can take out this legendary film director if he crosses the line. And it's also kind of silly. It's also a way to waste our time thinking about stuff that doesn't really matter. And if ever a movie didn't really matter, it was Eyes Wide Shut. And yet it's been taken very, very seriously in circles that otherwise don't waste time with movies. One of the things I'd say about Eyes Wide Shut and this kind of attention it's received because of its supposed occult hidden meanings is that it's a warning or a reminder to us that critical faculties are essential to the process of mapping the design of the Masonic elite or of anything else, and that to separate Eyes Wide Shut's aesthetic qualities from its supposed occult content is a mistake, because one can't separate style from content. We need to be able to judge the value of a work not by moral criteria but by aesthetic criteria. Yeah, I'm just going to move straight on to another subject now. This is a question of altruism. What is altruism? This was a subject that came up at a rigorous intuition thread that I started a long time back about Jake Kotze, and then that resurrected and somehow ended up on this subject as to is there such a thing as altruism. And I would say that altruism is rather like objectivity. It's a word that doesn't really have any absolute meaning. It has relative meaning. You could say this about all words, but some definitely more than others. One can't ever be objective, finally, and one can't ever really be altruistic without being entirely selfless, and that's a different thing. The idea of serving others, of altruism, is, in a sense, it's a valid idea for sorcerers, but it is only a bridge between the trap of acting for personal gain that every sorcerer better move beyond. It is a dead end. There is no way to bring the agenda of self-service into the realms of the imaginal. It is simply fatal. It's like trying to put the ocean in a box. It's like trying to capture infinity. How do we discern between the good and evil? How do we discern between right and wrong? it relates to sensibility, what pleases us, and so it is an aesthetic thing. There is no absolute right and there is no absolute wrong. And this idea of absolute right and absolute wrong, of absolute good and evil, and never the twain shall meet, is propagated by the Masonic sorcerers as a way to keep us locked into this value system that they have created. It's knowledge of good and evil. It keeps us from divine consciousness. And ironically, one of the primary ways through which they do this is by creating and propagating an image of themselves as satanic, evil, demonic elite. Now, if by their fruit shall ye know them is true, and I believe it is, then we can know these Masonic sorcerers through their fruit, and we can know that they do partake of an energy that is not desirable, is not appropriate to ourselves. We are not inclined to abduct, torture and sexually abuse small children, turn them into slaves, turn them into killers. We are not inclined towards these things. They are counterproductive. But to judge others for doing these things, in a sense, diverts us from our purpose, which is to tune into a different vibration, to a different wavelength besides that of ultimate evil, as it has become known, besides that of distorted energy, distorted sexual energy. But they serve as a means for us to see precisely what we do not want for ourselves. The darkness does bring out the light, so to sink to moral judgment is definitely counterproductive, and it's definitely playing into their hands. But as long as we do need to know what we like and what we don't like, what suits us, what our sensibility is, and we also need to refine our sensibility so that we're responding to ever more fine manifestations of the spirit and moving further and further away from the coarser aspects. This is alchemy. This is refinement. This is purification. This is how we align ourselves with the good, with the true, and with the pure. In the end, the only suitable emotion for those who've chosen to align themselves with coarseness, with impurity, and with lies is pity, is sympathy, empathy. We must empathize with their plight in order to fully understand it and to recognize those corresponding aspects within ourselves so that we know where they are and we can eradicate them, de-emphasize them, integrate them until they're gone, until they exist no more. So this is sort of a digression. I was getting to altruistic action and the idea that I posted on the blog recently, which is that we need to take what we do seriously. We need to take our ideas and our work seriously in order to do full justice to it, just as a warrior on the battlefield must take his enemies seriously, must take his knowledge of weapons seriously, his combat moves, all the rest of it. He has to be very, very serious about what he's doing because he's going to face his death, quite likely. But by the same token, he can't afford to take himself seriously because that just hijacks energy, attention from these things that he needs to take seriously and redirects it into the self. And this is true of artists. You see, artists who take themselves seriously aren't usually very good artists. They're dilettantes. They're more into the pose of being an artist. But then an artist who doesn't take himself or his ideas seriously is not an artist either. So that's not the solution. It's the artist who takes his work, or his or her work, seriously, puts everything into it, but doesn't take him or herself seriously, and therefore doesn't really care how they're presented through this artwork or how the world receives it. That's the true artist. Maybe artists we've never heard of, many of them, because they create for the joy of it and in service to the spirit, to the muse, to the unconscious. They're integrating, processing these aspects of the psyche that need to be aired, need to be understood. An alchemist turning lead into gold. That's what a true artist is, and a true sorcerer also is an alchemist. What this comes down to is that for the sorcerer. To be altruistic in the end is counterproductive, because this is also motivated. If we are acting to serve others, then we're also acting to please others. We're giving them what we think they want or what we think they need. There's still a personal agenda behind it, even if it's just the personal agenda of making people happy, knowing that they think well of us. Or even if we do our acts of charity in secret, we still have that warm glow of virtue of having done something nice. And there's nothing wrong with this. If we enjoy being good to others, then that's our aesthetic choice. That's our taste, and that means that at the very least we don't enjoy inflicting harm upon others. So we're definitely moving towards the good. But there's something beyond good and evil. And that is when we begin to act for the sheer hell of it. When we no longer have any personal motive behind our actions. Nothing to gain, nothing to lose, no agenda. This is where true sorcery comes into the picture, and it's essentially a not doing. So I'm going to round up now with the last question. This is the ideal of democracy. It was something that Aurora Girl at the blog brought up, that maybe we were overly indoctrinated with the ideal of democracy, and I certainly would agree with that. And I bring it up because it relates to another question that I brought up about the blog, which I wanted to cover in this place, which I think is quite key. It's also a continuation of the Illuminati RS podcast, which I broached upon some rather sensitive ideas, specifically about the idea of the elite being an idea that has been stolen from us. We can't talk about the elite as a good thing or as belonging to an elite without undermining ourselves, without somehow creating an impression, not just to others but in our own consciousness, that we are falling into a trap, that this is the wrong kind of way to think, that there is no elite, the elite is bad. Well, that's true, but it's also not true. The elite, as it has been structured, as we are understanding it, as we're being led to understand it through the dots that we are joining prematurely, is a bad thing. I will concur with that. The Egyptian elite, the pharaonic elite, the priests and the warriors underneath were the vast masses who we now call slaves, but who I have no doubt were not referred to as slaves in that time, is another matter. There is something resembling hierarchy in the universe, but it's not a structure of belief. It doesn't relate to one faction being above the other in the social sense. It is more like nature itself, or the universe, is arranged like a food chain is a hierarchy, of course. Does that mean that an animal that devours is better than, more important, or superior to one that is devoured? That doesn't really follow. And that at the same time, the hierarchy of the food chain must be observed, it must be recognized, because it is a simple reality. We have a similar sort of question, a similar sort of arrangement in awareness, that there are levels and levels of awareness. An individual can be measured according to their level of awareness. It's a very delicate and it's a very subtle thing, but it is a form of currency, so that two people can be measured side by side, and we can determine if our awareness is finely tuned to these matters. We can determine the levels of awareness of those two people, and we can to some extent compare them. However, this of course is far more complex than the rational mind could ever map, thank God, because the farmer's awareness of the fields and the crops and the natural cycles can't be compared to a computer programmer's awareness of software, of programs, etc. Both are equally valid. So it's to do not with the specific disciplines of awareness, but how they are used and inform a greater awareness which is universal, which relates to self-awareness. How we use our lesser awareness of natural cycles or computer programs or whatever it is as a lens through which to examine and configure our psyches and so come to self-knowledge. And this kind of awareness is, as I say, is a hierarchy. You can take two individuals in this world and compare them, and you can see that they very clearly are not equals. I'm not going to cite examples because that would be it's unnecessary. But if I were to cite an example, then I suppose I would throw out Jesus Christ and Obama, Barack Obama, or Jesus Christ and Ted Bundy. Clearly we're not talking about the same level of awareness here. They're not even comparable, really, and yet they can be compared. And how relevant is this? This came up at the blog because I suggested that the podcast, in an interview with Visigoth recently, I suggested that Stormy Weather is geared not towards awakening people to the nature of the Masonic conspiracy or anything else, but to addressing people who are already aware of these things and helping them, giving them a context, a frame of reference by which to use what they already know. And this was summed up by somebody at the blog that I was directing my podcast to the people who are awake rather than trying to awaken people. Well, again, awake is a relative term. Yes, so I am addressing people who are relatively awake or relatively aware. I do want to just backtrack a second and just quote something that Sounder wrote at the blog. Having awareness does not mean you are awake. It only means you are able to handle a bit more cognitive dissonance. What you do to resolve that dissonance determines awareness. I think that this is a valid comment, and definitely there's room for exploration of this idea. It goes back to what I was saying about the use of information to inform our sense of who we are, to inform the process by which we transform our psyches from personal to impersonal to archetypal, from the lead of emotions, personal feelings, of intellect, to the gold of sovereign divine consciousness. How do we do this? Through cognitive dissonance, through shocks, through holding in our consciousness ideas that we are not able to reconcile, like the surrealists, juxtaposing two objects that don't fit together to create dissonance in the perceiver that this is not reality, that reality has to be transformed, or our consciousness has to be transformed in order to hold these two ideas or objects in our consciousness simultaneously. We have to create a bridge between them, and it's this bridge building that I am constantly returning to, the bridge between good and evil, the archetypal terms, the reconciliation of Satan and Christ. What I wanted to say about the idea of being awake then and the elite was that there's no doubt that some of us are able to build these bridges and others are not, and that between those who can and those who can't, there's a very wide, large spectrum of degrees of those of us who are learning, and we have only so much time to learn. The desire to compare is insidious, to compare ourselves with others, and it's inescapable. That's what the rational mind does, and it's not entirely negative or counterproductive. It is mostly, if we use it to buoy up our own sense of self-importance, make ourselves feel better by comparing ourselves to people who we think are stupider or less awake than we are, or make ourselves feel shit by comparing ourselves to people that we feel we can't match. That's just a way for the ego to make itself stronger, to keep itself in charge. But if we use the idea of different levels of awareness, which we can perceive and map by looking at the world and people we know. If we use that as a means to compare within ourselves our potential from our actual state of awareness, if we compare our level of awareness in this moment from what it was a moment ago, or a day ago, or a year ago, these are all valid forms of comparison, because they're allowing us to become aware of the process of becoming aware, and what we need to do to realize our potential, to actualize our potential. So we do need to constantly compare ourselves, how we are now, to how we might be if we were to do things differently. And others can be a gauge for that, but not a consolation. Now, the lie of the Masonic sorcerer's liberal democracy, which is, of course, is just such taken such deep root in our collective consciousness as Westerners, it's really as great and as insidious a meme as Christianity, and it does relate even to Christianity, the idea that we can all be saved, Nietzsche's religion of slaves. The idea that liberals have about democracy and all the rest, racial equality and yada yada yada, everything, that we're all basically the same because we're all equal. While on the other hand, this idea, this political or social meme of liberalism and democracy coexists with a culture geared around celebrity, power, wealth, poverty, anonymity, the dichotomies that prevail in our society between success and failure, wealth and poverty, etc., goes totally against what we're supposed to believe. Because in a democracy, if it were truly a democracy, if we were truly all equal, then movie stars wouldn't exist, politicians wouldn't exist, we would all be self-governing, sovereign bodies. And that's the only equality that counts. As enlightened beings, if I may use that term, as fully activated galactic citizens, we are equal. In a sense, we're even the same, because what makes us different would just be our physical being. Our personal selves would have been erased through that process of awakening to our galactic selves. Well, they would have been de-emphasized to the point that they simply were not a factor in our consciousness. They weren't a determining factor. They would still be recognizable as memories. We would have personal memories. But essentially, what would make us individual then, as part of a galactic hive mind, would be our bodies, our physical beings. And so you could say that's everything, you could say it's nothing, depends how you want to look at it. Our DNA, the portion of DNA that equates to personal memories is negligible. Most of the DNA relates to impersonal species memory, and then beyond even species, galactic blueprint. So what I'm trying to get at now is that these two ideas can't really coexist in our consciousness. There's no way to bridge them, because it's not a paradox, it's just a contradiction. We can't all be the same and at the same time go around worshipping celebrities. We can't bang on about liberal democracy and support and sustain a society in which we are judged according to our paycheck, our social status, whether we're artists or whether we're street sweepers, etc. We clearly do not live in a liberal democracy. We live in a slave state run by an oligarchy, a cryptocracy. So let's call a spade, and let's take responsibility for the fact that we're slaves, and the fact that there is an elite, and the way to get free of that elite is clearly not to allow them to direct our beliefs about social arrangements. What's a good social arrangement? Well, the only way to erase an old program is to create a new program by which to erase it. One can't simply remove the old program, not if it's an essential program to the running of our consciousness. And this is what we're talking about, is the arrangement of the species into a hierarchy. We can't all just tear off our clothes and have a big love-in. We're not ready for that. We're not ready for this psychic splicing. First of all, we have to find the right arrangement, and that means that the old elite must be replaced with a new elite. Not through revolution, not through conscious intention, just through galactic intervention, It will happen. A new elite will arise. I'm here to say that. Let the chips fall where they may. As long as there is a society, there will be a controlling elite. Only when we're ready to let go of the whole notion of individual selfness and of society will the idea of an elite no longer be necessary. Will a hierarchy become totally organic, as it is in nature? So in the meantime, let's look at this question of the elite based on awareness. Those who have more awareness are more fit to direct and instruct and guide those who have less awareness. That's a natural hierarchy. And the idea that some of us are not more awake than others, that we're all equally awake or equally ignorant, is clearly a lie that is being fed to us by the elite who would keep us asleep. So we have to allow ourselves a little bit of self-importance or egotism or the appearance of such by saying from time to time, yes, I am awake. Yes, I am more aware than the vast mass out there who are just basically zombies. Now, we can say that as long as there's no judgment involved, as long as it's not a value judgment. This is where there is some truth in our reticence about making judgment or describing ourselves as aware. And it's because we have been programmed to think that qualities have value in and of themselves, so that if we are more aware or more awake than somebody else, that means that we're better than them. And so that makes us shy to say that we're more anything, just as rich people are embarrassed by their money. We want to feel that we're all the same, because it's easier to stay hidden that way. And it's very difficult to actually come out and say, I am this, I have this potential, and now I intend to fulfill it. Now I will give you a demonstration of this potential. Look how awake I am. Look how activated I am. This creates a sense of stage fright, it creates a sense of shame, of exposure, and add into the mix our social conditioning that says that this is just bad manners and politically incorrect. It's Nazism, it's fascism, to distinguish ourselves from others. And yet we don't mind worshipping celebrities and thinking they're special. So let's get over it, people. Just get over it. We're hypocrites, so what? Just try and align these opposing ideas, and if they annihilate each other, good, and if not, we'll just throw them out. Any opposites that don't cancel each other out are not true opposites. They're false, and they need to be discarded. And so this dichotomy in our psyches can be reconciled by accepting that there's nothing special about being special. There's nothing good about being good. There's nothing powerful about being powerful. We are simply different. And if we look at nature, what's the difference between a lion and a beetle? Is one better than the other? That would be foolish to say that. That's simply a value judgment, or at best it's an aesthetic judgment. We like lions better than beetles. I'd rather be a lion than a beetle, you might say. Personally, I'd rather be a beetle, because I think I have a sense of what the beetle's consciousness is like, and it is very, very intense. So unless we experience from the inside, we really don't know. We don't know what it's like to be blissfully ignorant any more than they know, these blissfully ignorant out there, the unwashed masses, who are now, of course, very well groomed, any more than they know what it's like to be a sorcerer. And neither of us know what it's like to be a member of the Masonic elite. We can only know by experiencing it from the inside. But we can know what we're drawn to, and we can acknowledge that there's a difference between a beetle and a lion. And to say that there isn't is just absurd. It's just silly. We need to grow up and get over it. We are different. You could say that humans are humans, and lions are lions, and beetles are beetles, so what's the comparison there? But the thing is that humans are not like the other animals. We have been given so-called free will. We can develop our own level of awareness and our functioning through self-examination, through alchemy, self-transformation, etc. And so the range of functioning and awareness in the human species is as great as that within the entire animal kingdom. If you take Jesus Christ and you take Ted Bundy, you have got as vast a spectrum of awareness there as between a lion and a beetle. They are that different within a single species, and that's what we need to look at. Where are we on this scale of awareness? What is our function? How do we take responsibility for it without going on a power trip over it? By acknowledging that being awake, being aware, doesn't make us better, but it does give us the responsibility to act at that level of awareness that we're at, just as a lion has to act like a lion, beetle has to act like a beetle. That's it. Lion doesn't sit around thinking, I'm a lion, hey, look at me. Doesn't happen. I guarantee it. So, if we can stop wishing that we were something else, then we can also stop preening ourselves over what we think we are. Stop giving ourselves credit simply for what we are. We can't take credit for what we are. We can't take credit for our level of awareness, not really. We can take credit for taking responsibility for it, as Sounder said. If we're using our awareness to resolve the cognitive dissonance that we are experiencing as a result of our levels of awareness, increasing levels of awareness, then we are using our free will wisely. So I'm getting near the end. One last thing, whether it'll tie in to everything else, I don't know. About emotions, something Aurora Girl mentioned about emotions being vital and valid, and of course I would agree with that. There's a tendency, I guess, in sort of self-transformative sorceress circles to devalue or degrade or even denigrate the emotions as beneath us, as needing to be risen above, and of course I would wholly disagree with that. The emotions need to be refined, which is a very different thing than transcendence. To some extent we do need to overcome our emotions, we need to get over them, but I think we can only do that by actually working with them and working through them. The idea of expressing your emotions is a tricky one. I think that 9 times out of 10 it really means just indulging in self-importance, and this is what I would like to get at, is that I think if we act out our emotions externally, if we stalk ourselves, again, to bring it to a not doing, so if we get angry or sad or petty or spiteful or despairing or obnoxious or anything else for the sheer hell of it, in the spirit of play, then I think we're coming a lot closer to really refining those emotions than simply letting them show when we feel them. I won't say anyone can do that, because that's not true, because a lot of people do have trouble expressing their emotions. But and so if you have trouble expressing them, by all means get them out. But how long does it take to really express your emotions? Once you've done it a couple of times and you know you can do it, then it's time to move on to the real sorcery, the real alchemy, which is refining those emotions. And that means not expressing them when you feel them, expressing them when you don't feel them, and when you feel them, transforming them and expressing them in different ways. That's the not doing of emotions. That's the alchemy that we need to do, because emotions, the thing is that they become addictions. Emotions are basically chemical, biological processes in the body. That's all they are. They're modes of consciousness that are experienced as bodily processes. So the body doesn't create emotions, but it's not quite right to say emotions create chemical responses in the body either. It's consciousness that's doing the creating. Consciousness expresses itself and experiences its environment as emotion and as biological chemical responses, and those are the responses that need to be refined by consciousness in order for consciousness to refine itself. And that's the process in a nutshell. Most of the time, however, we use emotions, we indulge in them under the guise of expressing ourselves as a means to consolidate our self-importance, strengthen our sense of identity. We feel good. They're pleasures. It feels good to be angry. It feels good to be sad. It feels good to be irritable. Whatever. The whole gamut of emotions. I can't even go there right now. They are all ways and means for us to escape, essentially. For us not to examine ourselves. Now, because if we're carried away by emotions, then we're not examining our emotions. We're identifying with them. So you can't examine something or understand something from the inside only. You also have to be able to see it from the outside. You need both points of view. So to be in one's emotions long enough to feel them as they are, to have empathy, as it were, with oneself, but then to be able to move out of them and to be able to move in and out of the emotions at will, that is the sorcery that is required here. But when we identify with our emotions, then we let them carry us away and we submit to them and they feed off us. We're basically giving our power because we're giving our attention to these emotions and we're taking them seriously. We take ourselves seriously when we take our feelings seriously. And this is simply not necessary. It makes it impossible for the alchemical process of refinement to occur as long as we're identified with those emotions, because we're not experiencing them as what they actually are, which is, as I said, is consciousness refining and being refined. Yep. So passion is what all emotion is being refined into. If one were to think of what every emotion would be in its purest state, which is also to say its most extreme manifestation, then the answer is passion. All emotions are being refined into a common substance, which I've chosen to call passion, like passion of the Christ. Passion, of course, means suffering, but that's not all it means. It's beyond suffering. Passion is when feelings become so intense that they flood out our sense of self. And instead of being identified with those feelings, we are transformed by them. It's a very subtle thing. But if we were to imagine how the universe, how the divine would experience itself at an individual level as a physical, psychological being, how it would experience every emotion as a baby experiences life, reality, as this unbelievably intense and wondrous flood of information and of connection to the environment. That's what passion is, and that's what our emotions would be experienced as if we were able to drop out of the personal self and into the impersonal. Everything would come down to pure love, pure joy, pure sorrow, pure passion. So that's what we should do. That's what we need to do. Don't take ourselves seriously. Don't take our feelings seriously. But take the process of being oneself and of feeling one's feelings. Take that process very, very seriously indeed. Because that's what we're here for. We're here to live as individual beings and to experience the slow and steady dissolution into galactic consciousness and say goodbye once and for all to flesh and blood. But as long as we're here in our bodies, then by all means, let's enjoy them. So go to that. Go do that. Go be that. This is Aeolus Cephas and Stormy Weather, bringing you news from the front line in the end times.